From telephones to chocolate. Next case is In Re Lawrence Foods, 2018-1060. Mr. Villeneuve.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Well, first of all, thanks the court for scheduling us so close to the initial date. This was really appreciated. So all I would like to say is that at issue today is very simple. It's one word, glaçage. And as a French-Canadian myself, I know how it's pronounced, but I've never met an American really that knows this word, that knows what it is, that knows how it's used, that knows its primary significance, and that is in the 4 years I have litigated this. I would like to introduce my client, Mr. Lawrence, a CEO, fourth generation. They've been doing icing for over 100 years.
But the trademark examiner made some findings, right? And why are they not based on substantial evidence? Findings as to what the public understands glaçage to mean.
Well, the office simply went online on one website, found a translation which we disagree with. We've provided translation. When I grew up, glaçage was a hockey penalty.
But that's evidence.
Well, they introduced a translation, which is a translation from one website. We introduced dictionaries, Larousse. We introduced many things. We introduced 14 or 13 definitions in total, and none of which had anything to do with their definition. So they offered a translation, which is different than a definition. But we offered definitions from the way this word is seen in France. For example, upon judicial notice, the improper judicial notice that they took, they offered something from the UK. And in the UK, this thing was egg wash. And they took judicial notice that the word glaçage meant, was a French word, and actually meant egg wash. Chocolate egg wash, of course, makes no sense. We challenged, one of the issues here is we challenged the way they did this. They reached out and they knew that they didn't have enough evidence to sustain this case. They didn't have any real dictionary definition. It's not in the United States.
So what are we talking about? Are we talking about a substantial evidence issue, or is there a legal error here?
There's both here.
What's the legal error?
Well, the legal error is, number one, they should not have taken evidence of all of these foreign websites. The TTAB by itself, since that time, has come out with several cases that say, unless you can prove, demonstrate that American eyes are on this website, there is no connection here, and you cannot prove that this, we cannot infer a meaning in the United States from what happens abroad. There's even a case where it is, like we cited, eBay.UK, the Tweeds case. So in the Tweeds case, they said eBay.UK, which is a very well-known website, is by itself not evidence. So the mistake is they grabbed this evidence, which they shouldn't have done, and then they provided no evidence as a matter of law that connects Americans to these websites, these different. We have been able to look at this evidence and find that about half of them were in the UK, were in Kuwait, were in Canada. Some were easy to diagnose, but the other ones we have no clue as of today. We don't know when they were authored. We don't know who authored them. We don't know.
So what are you saying, that they'd have to show that Americans access these websites?
The rule is very simple. In order to prove genericness.
Yes or no? Is that your theory, that they have to show that Americans actually access the website?
Well, actually, in their own precedents recently, they have said something like that. They have said that you need to show that actually some Americans would have seen this website and to have connected it. For example, on the internet, it's very easy to do. You can take any website and go on these crawlers, and they tell you exactly how many connections there are and how many people have looked at certain websites.
How many, but not necessarily from where, right?
Exactly. Well, again, if we're talking about...
It doesn't really help much.
Well, I understand. So, for example, if it's sumo wrestling and this mark is about sumo wrestling, we can assume that some Americans are going to look at a website in Japan that talks about sumo wrestling. I understand that. Our evidence that we provided is exactly that case. We looked, we said, where are people who buy icing? Where are they going to see? Where are they going to go? They're going to go to Betty Crocker, the American Bakers Association. They're going to go to the Food Network website.
Not necessarily. Some people fancy themselves the French chefs. And well, maybe they go, all go to, they're Americans, but maybe they go to French cooking sites in preference to Betty Crocker.
Well, we even provided evidence of Le Nôtre in Paris, exactly that. And they do not use glaçage that way. They actually, there was one recipe I found, just one, and it was actually some type of egg wash that yeah. was on top of a, that was a, not a savory, but a...
But let me ask you this. I understand that the examining attorney did not rely on the doctrine of foreign equivalence. But if the doctrine had been applied, why wouldn't this be a case in which it was perfectly suitable for its application?
It's very simple. The doctrine was not applied because the first word is in English and the other word is in English.
Well, does that really matter? I mean, if I had the sushi restaurant, you know, and suppose we were at an age in which sushi was less well known, surely the doctrine of foreign equivalence would apply to that.
Not, I agree with you, Your Honor.
You wouldn't be disqualified because of the word restaurant.
Exactly. So, assuming you are correct, which we don't assume, the case is Henri Ponsardin, which is the Veuve Clicquot, the famous champagne, and the word there was veuve in French, which was widow in English, and there was something out there on the registry that was about widow. And that was exactly the question. And the word veuve was found, it was a French word for drinking, and it was found not to be able to be translated under the doctrine of foreign equivalence.
Well, that was because, wasn't it, that the word widow wasn't associated with alcoholic beverages. Whereas here, the situation we're concerned with is icing. And the question is, if you translate it, it relates to icing.
We humbly disagree, Your Honor. When we go on Amazon and we put the word glaçage, what comes out is a beauty product, something that goes on the face and makes it shine.
Well, if this is a substantial, if this were to come up in the form of the doctrine of foreign equivalence and was viewed as a substantial evidence question, I think there would be ample sufficient evidence to say that glaçage has, as one of its principal meanings, some form of glaze or icing. I mean, you've introduced evidence to the contrary, but there's plenty of evidence that would support that conclusion, it seems to me.
Your Honor.
So assume that I were to conclude that there is plenty of evidence to support that. Is there any other reason that the doctrine of foreign equivalence wouldn't apply here?
Well, when the USPTO rejected us on descriptiveness, we didn't appeal to this court. We said, okay, we're going to go on the supplemental register and we will take 5 years. This is a company that manages hundreds of years. And we will come back. We will create secondary meaning and people will know this word. Then they came up with this notion that actually this term was generic. Now, in regards to generic, if we play that game, then it is chocolat, icing, icing. That's how he's selling it. And so if you take even the concept that actually the doctrine of foreign equivalent makes this word being replaced, when the average American stops, he stops and translates, so the average buyer here will see chocolate, icing, icing. Then that...
Well, that would be like saying that if you had a restaurant which was entitled Russian Pelmeni Dumplings... Pelmeni is dumplings. So you'd be saying Russian dumplings, dumplings, and therefore you could use it because it didn't mean to a Russian dumplings.
One of the problems I have is I know this word. I grew up with the mother and... Well, no, but...
You're not evidence.
No, I know. I'm not evidence. But what I'm saying is the evidence here to sustain a case for genericness is relatively straightforward. We need to prove that the average American, when you tell them this word, they know what it is.
Well, wait. Average American? I mean, probably the average American probably doesn't know what sushi is, but you don't have to have the average American. You don't have to have 150 million people that know what the word means as long as it's generic and there is a significant degree of recognition in the market for this particular product.
Well, we have defined a genus, and that's how it works. What is it and who does this mark apply to? how narrow is the segment, and it has been defined as the average ordinary customer, the average person, not a baker, not a chef, but the average person who buys icing. So that has been defined already. Under the doctrine of foreign equivalent, you are correct that actually there needs to be a segment of the population that is substantial. We've proven before, and that's why the doctrine of equivalent is not there, because I fought this issue for 2 years, and I proved that this word was not stopped and translated, in addition to the notion that nobody knew about this word here. The translation here, when I provided a translation of Larousse saying what it means here in the United States, it's a song. They even introduced evidence saying it was blue cheese, a type of blue cheese glaze or something. The main issue is that they have made a case, which is just the internet. We go on the internet, we put a word on the internet, we look at what comes up. We have made a rebuttal case that says, I can't find this word. There's not a single trademark that was filed where the goods and services read icing, colon, frosting, colon, glaçage. Nobody has ever filed a trademark in the United States of America, ever. The only person who's done it is him. I've introduced that evidence saying, since nobody who's ever filed for icing has ever, because that's what they do, they generally put synonyms in order to capture more on these certificates. Not a single certificate, not a single mark, not a single applicant. We've introduced the evidence, we put that word in, and it comes out completely blank. We've introduced all these websites. There's 20,000 recipes on Food Channel website. Not one recipe uses that word. Betty Crocker doesn't use it. The American Bakers Association doesn't use it. Nobody uses this word. And so the rebuttal case, which we're supposed to be given the benefit, and the benefit of this is, what does the segment of the population that buys these goods would think and associate? We've come out blank. So to finish my argument, in Ray Condrio, it was very clear. There was dictionaries, three of them. And what's important about dictionaries is not really the dictionary itself. It's the fact that people who put words in dictionary thinks about it. There's an editing process. There's a review process. There's a collectiveness that put things into the dictionary. So as for descriptiveness, it's just, what does the word mean? As for genericness, is, do Americans see that word that way? And so same thing for the Time magazine, same thing for this court's opinions. When words are picked very carefully and they are used very carefully, then yes, there is a presumption that these words are important. On blog posts that are from foreign places, small website, people who put comments, the USPTO itself has said, you know what, this is just not serious evidence. It's given no weight.
Save some rebuttal time. Do you want to continue or save it?
Thank you, Your Honor. I will save the last 3 minutes.
Ms. Heber, or is it Aber?
Heber, yeah. Right. Good afternoon, and may it please the court.
So what's the test for genericness? I mean, it talks about the relevant public, and here it's bakers and purchasers of baked goods. But what portion of the relevant public has to understand that this word glaçage means icing?
Well, there's no percentage.
No, I understand, right? There's no percentage, but a significant part? What's the test?
You know, it's funny. In trademark law, there's variations of how we say who has to recognize this. So there's things like substantial composite, a substantial portion. It's less than a majority. There's not any really defined amount.
Is it substantial portion the right test here?
It could be, but again, we're not quantifying the numbers.
Well, that's not quantifying it. That's saying what the test is. I mean, certainly that, you know, if 0.1% of the relevant public would recognize it, that wouldn't be enough, right?
I think that's fair, yes, but we don't have a way of measuring or doing surveys in ex parte.
No, I understand, but there's got to be a test. I mean, what are we, and it's particularly pertinent here because under Princeton, of course, you have to consider the whole record. There's a record that some parts of the relevant public don't use glaçage or don't understand glaçage to mean icing. So to have substantial evidence supporting the board's decision, we have to say, well, you know, they said they found these references and there are other references that didn't recognize it, but they found what, a substantial portion of the relevant public? I mean, I can't decide the case without knowing what the test is.
Well, Your Honor, I think you can because I respectfully disagree with the characterization that there's any evidence in this record that shows that people don't know of this term or recognize it, the relevant consumers. The kind of evidence that appellant put in here, they can't find it on Amazon, they can't find it on Walmart. That only goes to show that there's not somebody else yet out there making pre-made glissage for sale. And maybe it's not for sale on Amazon. Maybe you could find it in a grocery store, but you're not going to find it on Amazon. It doesn't prove anything about what consumers of baked goods...
You don't have a test for me.
Your Honor, I do. It's about the evidence showing what the meaning is to consumers.
In terms of the relevant public, what's the test? Significant part? Substantial part?
I think some portion of the public, some meaningful portion of the public. We have to have some comfort that we could infer a meaningful portion of the public would understand this term to mean a thing rather than indicate source. And we have that here. We have lots of recipes.
Does that meaningful portion test appear in any of the TTAB decisions?
Your Honor, I'm honestly not aware, and I apologize that I'm not having cases in mind that specifically set out.
This is not an old concept.
No, it isn't.
It's basic to trademark law.
That is correct, but there is not a percentage applied. I think that it is fair to say that, yes, you certainly have to have more than 1%. You can certainly have less than 50%, and somewhere in there is where we're concerned about, but we don't quantify it in terms of percentages. We're looking at the evidence to figure out.
That wasn't the question. I never asked about percentages. That's not the question. Is how do you characterize what portion, just in general terms, it has to be? And it seems to me that to decide these cases in a coherent way for the parties, there has to be some test which they're looking to.
I think an appreciable number. That's in other areas of trademark law. We've got some appreciable number, substantial composite. It's less than a majority. I apologize. I can't give you the exact phrasing right now. But I can give you comfort that this record has substantial evidence in it to support the board's findings.
Is the test whether the term is understood by the relevant public primarily to refer to that genus of goods or services?
That is correct.
That's the Martin Ginn case.
Yes, and that is in the statutory standard. It's the primary significance to the public. But I understood Judge Dyke to be asking me what portion of that public do we need to be focused on? And that I don't have a very, I apologize, I don't have a direct satisfying answer, but I would go with appreciable number, some portion of the public, it has to be that we have to have a comfort level that they would understand it to mean this. And we have that here because of the kinds of evidence we have here, which are recipes, we have articles, we have menus from U.S. cafes and restaurants that feature cakes enrobed in glissage, enrobed in chocolate glissage, the very term at issue here. And that is the same kinds of evidence that were found sufficient in Northland Aluminum, where the term bundt was found generic for ring cake mixes. There were four recipe entries there in cookbooks, some of which were foreign. There was the Israeli cookbook, and there were four food-related articles. I would submit there's more evidence here than was probably in the record in the Cordua case, where this court also upheld genericness, and there were articles, food-related articles. What we're dealing with here is food. It is international, and when we're looking at the sources that consumers are going to consult, we're looking...
If the American public would understand what it means, why are you requiring a translation?
So these are two separate things, as I think the board tried to explain in its decision.
They're sort of in opposition, though, aren't they?
They actually relate to one another, even though here the office made the genericness refusal because it found evidence saying, hey, in English, chocolate glissage seems to us to mean icing without the need for translation. So we're going to go that way. But the translation requirement is in the rule 2.32A9. It's a requirement for complete application that any time you have words of foreign origin in an application, the applicant is required to provide a translation for the record. The reason we need that is that the public can understand what the scope of the rights being claimed here is. What does this term mean in relation to these goods? Does it have a meaning? And the other reason is then, once the translation is of record, it enables the examining attorney to search properly, to figure out, should I apply the doctrine of foreign equivalence? Do I need to do that here? Does this term have descriptive significance? Does it have generic significance? Is there an English language mark for which I need to cite because it's likely to be confused with this foreign mark? So the translation requirement plays a very important role in the agency's ability to properly examine the applications, and it is a requirement of the rule for complete application. The appellant here had entered it in two prior applications. The examining attorney had a dictionary definition from the French-English dictionary, Collins. That is a reputable, reliable dictionary. All that the appellant came in with was LaRousse, French dictionary to French language speakers, not English language speakers, and his own translation of that. And even in that translation, there were some translations that relate to icing for pastries and cakes. And so the examining attorney said, this is the translation that is relevant for these goods, enter it, and they declined to. So it's different, though. That is an administrative requirement to have a complete application, and the translation as it relates to the actual substantive refusal, the agency here did not rely on the doctrine of foreign equivalence, although I agree with Judge Bryson, we probably could have, because the board has not issued a precedent where it is a combination of English and foreign wording. But the TMEP tells examining attorneys, you've got to look at what the nature of that wording is that accompanies the foreign wording. I think if it's distinctive wording, they might not apply it, but where it's generic, like the flavor.
Are you saying that if we don't agree with you on the merits, we should affirm on the failure to provide a translation?
Yes.
Well, we couldn't do that under Chenery, could we?
I think you could, because that is the basis. That's what the board did, too. They affirmed that.
No. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you say the translation?
Translation.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I thought you were saying foreign translation.
No, translation.
We couldn't affirm on foreign equivalence.
Foreign equivalence.
Because the agency
we didn't
never
speak to that.
Spoke to that, and we can't.
Right.
Translation. Yes. All right. I understand.
Correct. Sorry. Right. You have the evidence before you, but I don't think we need to go to foreign equivalence doctrine because this evidence shows that in English, these are all English language sources, chocolate glaçage and glaçage itself is used as a reference interchangeably for icing.
So you're saying the case is a slam dunk because they didn't provide a translation. The first issue was moot.
We could go that way. I think
if you want to win, either way, you're saying there's a winner.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, but they provided a translation in the other proceeding, right?
Yes, they did. Yeah. And that's the one that they're refusing to submit here. They have not provided, they refused to provide a translation for the record in this case. They did provide the translation in two other applications. I would just add, though, I don't think you should, but in the unlikely event that you would find fault with the board's decision on the merits here, the translation requirement would have to be entered.
An unlikely event. You know the data.
I say that only because this is a fact question. There is substantial evidence in this record that is unrebutted. I did just want to clarify one thing. The appellant has said repeatedly that the board has a rule now from the branded decision that public that we have to give evidence of the public's exposure to a website that's of foreign origin. That is 100% incorrect. First of all, branded is not a precedential decision, and it contradicts the precedent of this court and the board's manual and the board's own decisions in this area when they say they will give probative value to foreign website evidence. And there's basically two criteria. It has to be in English, and then they look for something that would Americans likely have consulted this site? Would they likely have been exposed to it? And so the nature of the goods and services can come into play there. If it's something that they're looking for information, they're going to consult the site. So recently, the board, in a precedent in 2017, the Living Lab, which was on appeal to this court and recently affirmed, not on this specific issue, the board there consulted a Canadian website. And they explained that we're going to give this website some weight because we think that people for looking for these goods and services would consult that website. That's exactly the situation that we have here. People use the internet to look for information. If I want a recipe about something, I'm really not going to a cookbook anymore. I'm going to go onto the website and say, hey, I want some chocolate glaze for my cake, chocolate glissage, and up pops all these things. The appellant even put in Google search results that showed some of the references that the examining attorney cited appear in that very first page of HITS. So we have a good comfort level that people would likely see those references here. And I would also submit that even if you wouldn't take any of the foreign ones into account, we have at least seven that are of U.S. origin of those websites and recipes and blogs. And that, I think, is really all I have to say unless there's anything else that you have questions about.
I do have a question, and this is circling back to Judge Dyke's original question. As a matter of policy, the idea behind generic, the prohibition against generic names for products is, I take it, that you just shouldn't be able to advertise yourself as being the source of the thing. You can't say, I am the thing. My product is the thing. Whether it's something that is recognized by everybody, as you can't have a restaurant that says food and then keep everybody else from using the word food in connection with restaurants. Similarly, I suppose that even a pretty obscure word, if as long as it's agreed that it's a name for a thing you can't use, I'm not sure why it should be necessary that a majority or even a significant number of people would recognize the word, let's say, plashad, to mean a horse. Just the people that happen to speak Russian. But why should you be able to appropriate the word horse, even if it's in another language?
You shouldn't, Your Honor.
Why is there any requirement that you have some kind of substantial or considerable number of people that would recognize it as such?
And that's why I'm sort of struggling with coming up for something with you, because I think there really isn't something in the genericness context. Even with the doctrine of foreign equivalence, where we're focused on the subset of consumers that speak the language, it's only a substantial composite of that subset that would have to be shown to have this generic understanding. Right. So I think it is a very low number. If it names the thing, that's exactly the reason why generic terms are not registrable. It has to be free for competitors to use. I'm sorry.
Do you have any insight into why the examining attorney in this case did not go to the doctrine of foreign equivalence?
Well, I think I don't, but I think it's because they found evidence in English that chocolate glissage means something, sort of like fondant or, you pick sort of a French cooking term. It's likely that you will find that in an English language source. And so the doctrine of foreign equivalence, it becomes potentially sometimes a little murky. I don't think it would be here, but I think it would be easy. I think it was probably just...
What would have been murky? I mean, what? How does it get murky?
I think it is because you have an English word combined with the foreign word, which I submit in this case, it's a generic word for the goods,
right.
And it's very similar to the French word that you have this whole thing in doctrine of foreign equivalence. Would they stop and translate?
Right.
And so if we can't answer that question with confidence, they didn't need to go there because it's just a guideline. They had the evidence here to make out the case that
we'll find out whether they need to go there.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Villeneuve has 2.5 minutes of rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I would just like to enter for the record two cases that the TTAB recently in 2017 and 2018 found. In this case, we find that foreign materials are very little evidentiary weight, and they specifically wrote that because they are foreign, like Cosmopolitan.uk or the Grazia magazine, because they are foreign publication, an applicant did not provide any evidence regarding their circulation in the United States, or whether U.S. customers would read these foreign publications.
So you're supposed to put that sort of thing in a 28J letter if you've come up with new authority so that they have an opportunity to respond to it rather than bring it up in the reply argument.
Are you going to give us a citation to those two?
Well, one of them, it post-date the reply brief, but if you want the citation...
That's what 28J is for.
Okay, so...
Post-reply briefs. All right, but why don't you at least...
Well, one of them is called In Re Denis Vonick, 2018 Westlaw, 2018-253, April 13, 2018. And the other one is called In Re Holland Atkins Ventures, LLC, 2017 Westlaw, 665726, TTAB, 2017.
Okay, thank you.
And send us a letter on them.
Thank you. Yes. And one final thing, in regards to the translations that we've offered, when she said that some of them were relevant, at page 19 of our reply brief, we've listed here exactly the definitions that the French people think this word is. And in regards to the definition, operations would give a smooth, shiny look to paper, glaçages, paper. Work which gives tailoring, which is two layers thick for the French. Heating of a meat in first order to get a surface which includes a thin, shiny layer. Cooking of small vegetables in a fat body and sugar. Covering of a pastry with fondant. So glaçage for them in France means this powdering of a mid-course of a pastry with glazing sugar that is then caramelized. None of it has anything to do with icing or our goods.
Last one sounds like it's pretty close.
It's not. This is glaçage, not glacé. Glacé is the verb, actually. But I understand what Your Honor is saying in regards to that. And then finally, in regards to the doctrine of foreign equivalent, I can say that I fought with the office in the previous case, which was the one that went up for descriptiveness, and we fought for 2 years, and the office withdrew that and conceded the fact that actually the doctrine of equivalent in this case for this mark did not apply.
And was there a reason given?
Yes, because we provided all these precedents saying there's no stop and translate, there's no significant percentage of the population who knew this word. I provided numbers of people who speak French here who could recognize this.
Okay.
And then, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.